Notable Women Through Maine's History. Many of the most influential people in Maine history were women, from poet Edna St. Vincent Millay to U.S. Senator Margaret Chase Smith. Women from Maine have led political and cultural movements for as long as this was a state. And it wasn't just famous women at the forefront. Of course, during World War II, female welders and electricians built the critical Liberty ships. But did you know that young female textile workers in Biddeford led what is considered the first ever labor strike in the U.S.? I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will look back at the history of women in Maine. We'd love to hear your story. Is there a grandmother or great-grandmother whose story you'd like to share? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. For Maine Public Radio, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Over the centuries, women have helped define Maine's identity, and some female leaders have even helped shape the nation. Today, we examine the role that women have played in our state over the centuries. This show is part of our ongoing coverage of topics related to Maine's bicentennial. Joining me, Beth DeWolf. She is professor of history and co-founder of the Department of Women and Gender Studies at the University of New England. Eileen Egan, associate professor of history at the University of Southern Maine, now retired. And Anne Gass, she is the author of Voting Down the Rose, Florence Brooks Whitehouse and Maine's Fight for Women's Suffrage. As always, we want to hear from you. Is there any aspect of women's history in Maine that you're particularly curious about? Do you want to call attention to a particular woman who made a difference? You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, post a comment to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Eileen, I'll start with you. We want to talk about some of the significant women who were from Maine over the centuries. But first, let's go back to the earlier days of Maine history, since this is a bicentennial show. Around the time period when Maine was founded 200 years ago, what was the fairly typical life of a woman in Maine? It was pretty hard scrabble, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, it depended, of course, which you were. Like for Native American women, they had their own set of experiences, and it was defined by sort of people's incursion into their lands. For farming women, they had a different experience than, say, women living in the towns. But basically, there was no electricity, there was no internet, there was no radio. There was not much birth control, to be frank, so people were having large numbers of children. And so women's lives were shaped by the fact that there was this ideology that not so much that women's place was in the home, because it was often out in the field, but there were certainly defined roles for women, of which having children was a big one.
And my understanding is women, a typical woman was having a baby every other year.
Yes, and they started pretty early, although actually not as early as sometimes later. But there was really nothing. People might try to nurse to keep it longer, but by and large, you could have 14 kids quite easily. This was true of some of the immigrants, too. This time period, the Irish immigrants, as well as some Canadians coming down, were coming to the country and also bringing children, as well as then having children here.
Beth, much of the recorded history of women is tied to the work they did, and a significant source of work and income for women in the 1800s was in the mills and factories. Tell us who the women were who were working the mills and factories, where these were, and what the work was like.
Sure. In the early period, from around the 1830s to the mid-1850s, the textile mill workforce in Maine, and principally at that time it was in Biddeford and Saco, and then spreading up to Lewiston, the workforce was comprised of the daughters of New England farmers. These were white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women. And as Eileen mentioned, in an earlier generation, these women would have been working in the field or working in the home, making textiles, making candles, making soap. But by mid-century, those products, it was simply cheaper to buy them. So you have a group of young women who are not quite ready for marriage, but have turned into somewhat of an economic drain at home. So why not put their hands to good use? Here are dutiful, submissive, again, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant women who can work in the textile mills, earn cash wages for their labor, and either help out their families or put those wages aside for what many assumed would be their final role, marriage and motherhood in the future.
Yet there was a lot of, what was the word I'm looking for? There was some tension around this. They were helping out the family and setting aside money for themselves, but they were also looked upon, there were negative connotations to working in the mill.
Absolutely, because mill girls learn very quickly the value of their own labor. And what's really interesting when you look at mill girls, both from Maine and from Lowell and some of the bigger mills in Massachusetts, what you see is initially the mill girls are very dutiful and send their wages home. And then you'll see in diaries or letters, "Dear Papa, here are my wages. I've held back a few because I need a new pair of boots or I need a winter coat." And then a little bit longer, girls are holding back a few more of their wages and not perhaps buying necessities, but buying what were called gewgaws and fripperies. So this sets middle-class wags of thinking. Can girls really manage money? Are they wasting money? Are they wasting their time? And this will show up, interestingly enough, not only in ministers' sermons, but in a genre of fiction where it's quite sensational. Young girl goes to the mill. She wastes her money on hair ribbons and candy. She might even skip Sunday church services. She meets a young man. She thinks he loves him. The next thing you know, she's dead. And this is commentary on middle-class New Englanders wondering, is mill work, is wage work, really the best opportunity for young women? Perhaps they should just stay home.
Eileen, I want to ask you about, we're talking about the 1800s, about the role of women during the Civil War. We know, I think, a lot about the role of women during World War II, especially those who worked in the shipyards as well, Rosie the Riveter and welders and electricians. Mm-hmm. But what about during World War II? What was the life of a woman in Maine like then, and what was the role of women?
You mean the Civil War?
The Civil War, yeah.
Right. Well, actually, there's a good book about Maine women in the Civil War. A fair number of them went as nurses. Of course, in those days, they weren't allowed to be in combat, but as a practical matter, if you were a nurse, you might as well be in combat because there you were. So on the one hand, you had people going to the home front. On the other hand, you had people working at home doing things like making stuff to be sent or taking care of people when they got sent home from the sanitary commission. Sometimes they had fairs to try and raise money to help take care of the soldiers. The other thing is a lot of women were involved after the war in trying to commemorate the war and the soldiers through all the statues that you see around Maine, including the large one that's in Portland. So women weren't formally recognized for the work, and of course they couldn't vote, but you couldn't have really had the war. What they didn't do really is go so much at that point into factories.
Anne, I want to bring you into the conversation. I think at the beginning of the program, Eileen briefly mentioned Wabanaki women. What can you tell us about the role of women in Wabanaki life and culture?
Women were very important to Wabanaki life and culture. They, had a very important economic role in their families. There's one woman, Florence Nicole Shea, was an outspoken advocate for Penobscot tribal rights, and but she was also a basket maker, and she and her family would make baskets and sell them to tourists and to other whites, And there's a book about her called Florence Nicole Shea, Penobscot Basket Maker and Tribal Advocate. And I, I, you know, that leads right on up to today. You know, Molly and Dana is a Penobscot Nation tribal ambassador and does a tremendous job advocating for Native rights. So I think their role has been there throughout.
I want to sort of turn back just a little bit to the Mill Girls that you were talking about, Beth. And I'm really interested in hearing a couple stories. I know you've been doing some research about some specific women. Tell us their stories and what makes them so interesting to you.
Sure. One aspect of mill life that I've looked at, and again, it relates to sensational fiction, is the way that mill girls' stories get presented to the general public. One thing I'm very interested in women's history are the stories of women who don't become famous, don't lead tribes, don't advocate for suffrage and get noticed in the newspaper, but rather the women whose stories we only know because of something sad or unusual happens to them. And so one example is a young woman named Beringer Caswell. She is one of these typical mill girls from the 1840s who ended up working in the Amaskeague Mill in Manchester, New Hampshire, where she met a young man from Biddeford. And they engaged, as young men and women do, in what were called criminal relations, which left Beringera pregnant by the fall of 1849. Beringera left the mills, as did William, and they reunited in Saco, where Beringera explained her dilemma to him. And they ended up at the home of a local doctor in Saco named James Smith, where he attempted to end Beringera's pregnancy. But in the course of doing so, Beringera contracted septicemia, and she died as a result. Dr. Smith panicked, and while abortion was legal in 1849, because of a rather convoluted loophole in the law, if your patient died, that was a problem. And Smith may have been involved in some other criminal activity. And so he tied her body to a board, dropped it in a stream, thinking it would go into the Saco River, and that would be that. Unfortunately, 4 months later, her body was found. And this set Saco, Biddeford, Maine, New England, anywhere where there was a textile mill, just agog at this crime that at one time was described as the first murder of a Saco resident by a Saco resident. What becomes the crux of this conversation and concern is not so much that she had an abortion, but rather this is yet another example of New England's best daughters coming into primarily and previously male economic realms, economics, wage labor, the big bad city of Saco and Biddeford, and ending up dead. And so much information, so much fear came out of this story that numerous people from across Maine were writing to the sheriff in Saco, "Is the body you found in the stream my daughter?" So what is really being discussed in the subsequent trial of the doctor for murder is, where is the safest place for women? What are appropriate roles for women? And do we really want young women to have geographic mobility and be out of sight of parents? Economic freedoms, have a little bit of cash wages, and therefore opportunity of their own. When we look broadly at this period, what Beringera Caswell's very sad death represents is a shift, one step forward for women in taking on some of the opportunities their brothers enjoyed as a matter of course. But every time there's a step forward, there's a step backwards with, again, these moralizing sermons, this sensational fiction, newspaper accounts and court cases, which all reach the same conclusion. Women, stay home.
Eileen, the stories of mills are linked to the story of immigrants in Maine. Talk about some of the different immigrant groups who helped shape Maine and the kind of works that the immigrant women did.
Sure. Depending which part of Maine, obviously a lot of French Canadians and Francos came down both from Quebec and also from Nova Scotia and came down that way. And then down towards Portland and a little bit north, you got, before the Civil War and after, the largest immigrant group was actually Irish immigrants. The interesting thing about the Irish immigrants is that, in fact, a large percentage of them were single women who came by themselves. Later groups like Italian immigrants and Jewish immigrants tended to come either as families or first as men. Well, men first, really. But lots of single Irish women came, and that meant then that they, like sort of like new immigrants, too. Women went to work in not textile mills, but in especially in meatpacking, fish packing, hotels. So they really were an economic mainstay. And then, again, like the new immigrants, they sent money home to their families, and they often would engage in serial immigration, which is a good thing, really, that they would send money back to Ireland, or the French women would send money back to Quebec or to Nova Scotia to bring maybe their sister or other relatives to come. But they were sort of a mainstay of working in the factories, the French women in particular, in Lewiston, Auburn, and other areas. And the Irish tended to work a little bit in fish-packing places, but also as domestics and in the rich people, the rich white Anglo-Saxon Protestant people's houses, and also in hotels. But they really were an economic force in terms of building up Maine industrially and also building up a middle class.
And Anne, what would you like to add about the lives of the young women who went out into the workforce, whether immigrant or not, during the 1800s?
Yeah, that it was interesting listening to Eileen just now, because my great-grandmother, Florence Brooks Whitehouse, about whom I wrote the book, my mom used to tell me that she would take in Irish girls who were pregnant, and sort of they could work for her through their pregnancy until they had the baby and adopted it out, or whatever happened to the baby, I don't know. But that was, you know, sort of speaks to both the fact that women were on their own engaging in premarital sex and having, you know, getting pregnant, because of course there was no birth control to speak of, but also that the Irish were, as Eileen pointed out, involved as or working as domestic workers in wealthy people's houses. But in general, I mean, I think there was a ton of concern around the, especially late 19th, early 20th centuries, about the increasing freedoms that women, young women, had when they left the bosom of the family, if you will, and moved into the cities to work in the factories. And at that point, they were, you know, they might live in boarding houses, but they were effectively beyond the reach of their family's supervision and could get up to all kinds of trouble. And, you know, the country is, I think, still struggling with, you know, women's sexuality and ability to be sexually active. And it really, you see that, you know, a lot of concerns reflected around then. It extended through World War I when the government instituted what's called the American Plan, where basically they could lock women up on suspicion of having some sort of venereal disease with no due process whatsoever. And you know, test them and treat them with no permission given by the women at all. The courts upheld this American plan, and it lasted up into the 70s. And it reflected, I think, in part the country's anxiety about women's freedoms and especially sexual freedoms.
Well, I want to ask you more about Florence Brooks Whitehouse, but we do need to take a break. We're talking about women's history in Maine. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Levitt and Sons Deli, committed to helping you hunker down with curbside pickup and delivery of their chicken pot pie and shepherd's pie. True Line, a full-service marketing and branding agency who believes in the value of local independent journalism, online at wearetrueline.com. And Fresh Eggs Daily, a Maine business committed to helping others raise backyard chickens from hatching chicks to laying hens, fresheggsdaily.com.
Welcome to Maine Public's This is My Maine. For me to live in Maine, it really means just this connection with place. I was born here, I've grown up here. I haven't really left the state for more than 2 weeks or so ever. There is something distinct, I feel like, about the people from here. And, you know, I think it's kind of a connection to the land. It's a more traditional culture in certain aspects with regards to farming and fishing. It's just a really unique place in terms of history. My name is Lowell, I'm from Orono, and this is My Maine.
This is My Maine is brought to you through the support of Eaton Peabody, the Maine Community Foundation, and the generous support of members like you. Thank you. Go to mainepublic.org to experience more of Maine Public's celebration of Maine's first 200 years. Happy birthday, Maine.
Maine Public continues to celebrate the first 200 years of Maine's statehood. We're sharing historical information, interesting facts, and personal recollections, both by looking back at how this great state of Maine developed and also peering ahead for the next 200 years. All of our radio and television bicentennial programming, including On This Day in Maine History and This Is My Maine, can be found again or for the first time at mainepublic.org. The Maine State Bicentennial Hub link is under the radio, television, or education dropdowns, and you can also find links at mainepublic.org to our bicentennial partners, including the Maine State Archives, the Maine Historical Society, and the Maine State Bicentennial Commission.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, the history of women in Maine and how they've helped shape our state over the years. My guest, Eileen Egan, who is a retired associate professor of history at the University of Southern Maine. Anne Gass, historian and author of a book about suffrage, Voting Down the Rose. And Beth DeWolf, professor of history and co-founder of the Department of Women and Gender Studies at UNE. As always, we want to hear from you. Email talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, post to our Facebook page, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now, Candace Keynes, who is a journalist, historian, speaker, and former curator of the Maine Memory Network. Candace, thanks so much for calling in.
You're welcome.
You know, the Maine Memory Network is someplace that I can get lost for hours on end. I can't even imagine being the curator of that. I bet you had a lot of late nights. We haven't talked much about the lives of African-American women in Maine. Some of your research has been on the formerly enslaved people who moved here in the 1860s. Why did they come here? And what was it like for the Black women who arrived and settled here back then?
Well, they came because, let me give you a little background. During the Civil War, as soon as Union troops arrived in the South, the enslaved people started leaving their plantations or wherever they were and joining, following the Union troops because they believed they would be safe and could get away from slavery. And they were called contraband, for a lot of reasons, but they were men and women who did that and followed Union troops. So when the Emancipation Proclamation was announced in January of 1863 that effectively freed the slaves, or technically freed the slaves in the Confederate states, even more people started leaving, more formerly enslaved people started leaving the plantations. And some of them, some of the people who came to Maine came with soldiers they had met when they escaped to Union camps. Others came after the Civil War through the auspices of the Freedmen's Bureau, which was charged with resettling people, the formerly enslaved people who didn't want to go back to a plantation, or the plantation was gone, and they, even if they went back to where they had been, they were supposed to be paid for their work now. But anyway, so a number of people came to Maine through the Freedmen's Bureau, and the head of the Freedmen's Bureau was Oliver Otis Howard of Leeds, Maine. And so partly through connections with him, people came here, but others came with soldiers. And the reason they came was to get away from the South. They thought things would be better in the North, and they believed they'd be able to find jobs. And if they came through the Freedmen's Bureau, somebody had to request that they come for work.
Mm. And Howard famously founded later Howard University. What was life like for them when they arrived, Candace?
Well, you know, it's hard to tell because it was illegal to teach slaves to read and write. So most of the people who came were not literate. So they didn't tell their own stories. Some newspapers became very interested in these formerly enslaved people and wrote stories about them. So, you know, it's not through their own words, but kind of through their own words. And so it's a little hard to tell, but most of the women were employed as domestic servants who came from the South. And that some of them came with husbands, or in a few cases, their husbands came before they did, especially if they came here with a soldier. And then they would say, oh, but wait, I got separated from my wife and children during the war, and I want them to come too. And so then they would come as well. But most of the single women who came ended up being domestic servants in somebody's household or occasionally in a hotel or something like that. And so I think, you know, in some ways their lives were probably better than they had been before. But if you can imagine the disruption of a war on your home territory, the uncertainty of what's going to happen, and then being sent usually by sometimes ship and train to a totally different climate and culture than you were used to, it had to be a little unsettling. But I can tell you about a couple individuals and what happened to them, which are some interesting stories.
Go ahead.
Well, one of them is a woman named Lulu Osborne, and she was a little less than a year old. She was born in 1864 in Virginia, and her parents, and she was the third child, so there were two older daughters, and her parents had been separated because of the war, and her father, Samuel Osborne, went to Waterville with a soldier named Stephen Fletcher, who was a Colby graduate, and thought Waterville would be a great place for Samuel Osborne. So later, at some point, within the year, Osborne's wife and these three children came, and Lulu Osborne was, as I said, less than a year old, and sometime within her first year in Maine, a Colby professor and his wife took an interest in her, and they were named Charles and Elizabeth Hamlin, and they adopted Lulu Osborne, either legally or in practice, and even though she kept the name Osborne, she lived with them, and they moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts in 1873, and she went with them. But the reason they adopted her is they were Samuel Osborne was strongly anti-slavery. He believed in the equality of blacks and whites, and he thought it would be a way to, by adopting Lulu and raising her, they had no children of their own, he thought he would be proving that with the right environment and education and so forth, blacks could do as well as whites. And so
sort of a My Fair Lady fantasy there.
Yeah, she became his experiment. And in fact, she did end up going to what was then called, it might have been called Kentucky State University. I'm not sure what the name of the school was in Kentucky. And she ended up teaching there, and then she married a man who had been a free black in New Jersey. and they both were teachers. And but she stayed in touch with her family. But the interesting part of that story is there were the three girls who were born into slavery, and then the family had three more children in Waterville. Samuel Osborne was the janitor at Colby College for 37 years, and his story actually gives a lot more insight into how people thought about black people in a predominantly, almost exclusively white community. He was much beloved, but in what we might now think of as kind of a patronizing way.
Mm. You know, anyway, I'm going to, yeah, thank
one,
you. I'm going to ask you to stay on. Go ahead.
Okay. Well, three of the daughters became teachers, not just Lulu Osborne, who was raised by the Hamlins, but two of the other daughters also. And one of the youngest daughter, who was born in 1879 in Waterville, was the first black woman to graduate from Colby in 1900.
Wow.
So,
Candace, I'm going to ask you to stay on the line with us a little longer as we continue our
okay.
discussion. But, Anne, I want to ask you, you mentioned before your grandmother, Florence Brooks Whitehouse, and I want to ask you about her, your relationship, what you've learned about her, and also just touch on Maine's role in women's suffrage.
Yeah, so Florence was my great-grandmother, my mom's grandmother, and she was born in Augusta but moved with her husband to Portland when she got married and lived there the rest of her life. She was an artist, sort of an amateur artist, but a novelist. She published two novels with Little Brown and Company, and she had traveled, before she got married, she traveled extensively around Europe and the Middle East, kind of did her own little world tour there. And then came back to marry, and she ended up, they had three children, and she kind of devoted herself to her family and to her novels and her music. She was also a fine soprano singer. And it wasn't until she was in her 40s that she joined the suffrage movement in Maine. And this was around 1913 or so, 1914. And because she had written and acted in plays and written these novels and was used to sort of managing her time well, she was a very effective organizer for suffrage and quickly kind of became the person they hoped would lead the Maine Women's Suffrage Association. She ended up disappointing the Maine suffragists by deciding to become the Maine chair of the new Congressional Union, the branch of the main branch of the new Congressional Union, I should say, which was formed by Alice Paul and Lucy Burns, and she becomes chair in 1915. They formed this new branch. And, of course, the Congressional Union was much more activist in some ways than the old Maine Women's Suffrage Association, and they believed in picketing the White House and organizing against the Democrats who were in power in Congress for failing to move a federal amendment enfranchising women through the Congress. And so, you know, nowadays that stuff doesn't sound too challenging or radical to us, but at the time it was incredibly radical, and she lost a lot of friends over that. There was a lot of backlash against her personally and against the Congressional Union for supporting those kinds of methods. And she stuck it out, though. She stuck to her guns, and she was really the lone voice in Maine in the last years of the campaign supporting the Congressional Union and the White House pickets. She herself also picketed President Wilson. She traveled to Wyoming to campaign against the Democrats in 1916 and was involved in this kind of street brawl in Chicago on the way out there. It was quite a famous event in suffrage history. And you know, through it all, she just kind of stuck to her guns, and ultimately, I think she was recognized by the Governor Milliken of Maine as being the person who really made it possible for the Maine legislature to ratify what became the 19th Amendment in 1919. They voted on that, and she and Alice Paul were up in Augusta in the final hours, you know, twisting arms and making sure that the Maine legislature delivered a yes vote on the 19th Amendment. So she was really quite a woman. And what's remarkable to me is that I knew nothing about her until I was in my 40s, because my family had forgotten about her and just didn't know her stories. And also, the little that was written about Maine suffrage portrayed her as this kind of radical fringe person who caused more problems than she did, you know, than she helped out in the movement. And so it took me quite a long time and a lot of research in Maine newspapers and in the Library of Congress and lots of different places to figure out what it was that she did, and that she actually was the leader that she was at that time.
We're talking about the history of women in Maine. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can get an email in talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Modern Pest Services, offering a non-toxic approach to pest control with anti-CMEX smart pest control technology. ModernPest.com. The University of Maine at Augusta, committed to providing a quality, affordable education online and in the classroom, uma.edu. And Dead River Company, committed to keeping Maine's homes and businesses warm and proud to be part of celebrating Maine's bicentennial, deadriver.com.
French explorer Samuel de Champlain and his party approached Mount Desert Island on September 4, 1604, and later named Maine's largest island. The explorer's observation that the summits of the island's mountains were free of vegetation as seen from the sea led him to call the island L'Isle de Mont Désert, meaning Island of Barren Mountains. The explorer noted his initial observations. From this island to the mainland on the north, the distance is less than 100 paces. It is very high and notched in places, so that there is the appearance to one at sea as of 7 or 8 mountains extending along near each other.
On This Day in Maine's History was created in partnership with the Maine Historical Society and made possible through the generous support of Roosevelt Campobello International Park and the Island Institute. Happy birthday, Maine!
When a COVID vaccine is approved, who gets priority?
It's just not a slam dunk that the old people would get a high priority right behind healthcare workers and essential workers.
On Next, from the New England News Collaborative, we look at how the government will decide. Plus, a Canadian court ruling has implications for refugees trying to cross into Canada from northern New England. Please join us.
And that's coming up this afternoon at 2 o'clock here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling, and today's topic is a look back at the women of Maine over the centuries. Joining me, Candace Keynes, who is a journalist and historian, Anne Gass, historian and author, Beth DeWolf, professor at UNE, and Eileen Egan, a retired USM professor. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. A comment from Atim: there were free blacks here in Maine when it became a free state. The Fugitive Slave Act of 1850 scared many blacks away because people were being snatched, like in the movie 12 Years a Slave and Enslaved. An email from Charles: Margaret Payson of Portland was a quiet innovator in social services in Maine from the beginning of the 20th century. Famously, a few years ago, her name turned up in a letter by Governor Baxter, buried in the Kittery War Memorial. Baxter wrote, "I asked Margaret Payson to marry me, and she turned me down. She's still single." Also notably, Margaret Payson turns up as MP in the letters of Henry James, written in London during the summer of 1914. According to James, Margaret criticized him, telling the expat writer, "We don't do it that way in Portland." Following World War I, Margaret Payson founded Social Services for the Children of Maine, was a major financial backer behind Maine Medical Center, and in the 1970s helped to fund the construction of a new building for the Portland Museum of art. And yes, she did, in fact, remain single during her life. So, Charles, thank you for that wonderful email. And Eileen, I want to turn to you. Who is somebody that you would like to highlight that perhaps is not as famous as Margaret Chase Smith or Frances Perkins or Edna St. Vincent Millay?
Well, actually, I do think that Frances Perkins should get more attention than she does. But the other people are actually are groups of women. If we think of social service, for the Catholics and the Irish immigrants, the Sisters of Mercy, and there is actually a statue of Margaret Macaulay, who was not from Maine, obviously she was from Ireland, and also one of Marguerite Duval. And both those religious orders, I think, deserve attention because in an era when there were no social networks, the government didn't provide any kind of assistance to people, and there were women who gave birth without fathers being around to support them. The role of those orders and the nuns in those orders really should be paid attention to.
All right, I want to turn to you and ask you the same question, Beth. Who would you like to highlight?
I would choose, of the many women's stories in this state, a woman named Mary Baker, who in the 1850s was a hair worker. And I choose her because she represents the legions of women that, again, aren't famous, but really made a living through entrepreneurial skills. And a hair worker was someone who took human hair and wove it, braided it into jewelry, which was then exchanged between friends as a sentimental seal of their friendship, or would weave it into flowers, which were then made into wreaths displayed in homes to remember your family's dead. And Mary Baker, through the 1850s and into the 1860s, made a living through hair work.
What about you, Anne? Other than your great-grandmother, who is somebody in Maine, a woman in Maine history you wish got more attention?
Well, I think Gail Laughlin is one that I have a huge amount of respect for. She was an Irish immigrant. I don't know if she was born here or came as a baby, but she grew up fairly poor, graduated, I think, from Portland High School, and ended up becoming an attorney, and she moved to the West Coast. She lived in California for quite a number of years, practiced law out there, and was really active in suffrage, and then moved to Colorado with her partner. She was I believe she was a lesbian, and they lived in Colorado for a while before she returned to Maine in the 20s and ended up getting elected to the Maine legislature. So she was quite a modern woman in that sense that it was used, that word was used at the time, or that term, and just, you know, in that she moved around the country. She supported herself, became a lawyer at a time when it was pretty unusual for women to do that, and was very active in the suffrage movement, especially the Congressional Union. And she actually served on the board of the Congressional Union here in Maine at different times.
And this was Gail. Tell me her last name again.
Laughlin, like Laugh, L-I-N.
Uh-huh. And what? When was she alive?
I don't have her dates in front of me, but she would have been roughly similar to my great grandmother. So maybe like 1870s or later. I mean, maybe even like 1880s or 90s, and then. I'm not sure when she would have died, but she was definitely a little bit younger than Florence.
Yeah, if I could leap in here, Gail Laughlin was not the first woman in the Maine State Legislature, but one of the first, and she was still in the legislature in 1924. I'm not sure when she died.
Wow. And Candace, I was going to go to you next.
How about a woman named Narcissa Stone, who was from Brunswick, and she lived during the 19th century, and there was once a restaurant here named after her, but it went away. But anyway, she was an amazing businesswoman. Her father owned a dry goods store, and she was the oldest of 10 children. She
helped him with his dry goods store. And eventually she became the business person in the family. One of her brothers took over the dry goods store, but she invested in hotels. She invested in water power. She was active in getting mills along the Androscoggin River in Brunswick. And she was also very philanthropic and active in lots of community organizations, and was probably one of the best known people in this area in the 19th century. And there was this huge funeral when she died.
All right, we're going to go to Joe, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Joe, go ahead.
Hi, I just wondered if anybody remembered a nameless woman who was discovered reading a book during the day on her in her house in Maine, and her husband and she were shunned for the rest of their lives in the little farm town that they lived in. It was on the radio reader in read in Portland, Maine, years and years and years ago.
Beth, do you know that story?
I don't, but it sounds fascinating, and certainly there are a number of examples throughout New England of similar things where women who were caught reading, particularly in the 17th century or even into the early 18th, were said to be deranged, or if they read too much, it would lead to their insanity. In fact, there was a poem that asked, why should women be learned or wise? Reading only spoils their eyes. And so I don't know the Maine woman, but boy, I would love to know her name if anyone else does.
It could still be true.
That's right. Joe, thank you so much for your call. I want to point out a book that I gave as gifts a few years ago. Kate Kennedy, a Maine author, wrote a book, mm-hmm. Maine's Remarkable Women, and she highlights a number of women that were mentioned so far on this program, but so many more as well. And it's really just remarkable how many women throughout Maine history, from the famous names like Margaret Chase Smith and Sarah Orne Jewett to others, who are not quite as famous, Tate Blanche and Toy Lee Goon, Len Goon's story. So acknowledging that this is a very short program today, we're only scratching the surface on some of the famous women. Eileen, I want to turn to you, though, and talk about Maine's women in politics. We do know about Margaret Chase Smith and obviously Olympia Snow, Susan Collins, a female governor here. Is Maine unusual in the outsized influence that Maine women have had in politics?
Well, a friend of mine, Polly Kaufman, always, who knows about these things, always argues that it's true. And I think it's only slightly true, because actually if you looked at each of these states, you'd find there have been more women rising to the fore than you would think. And it's worth remembering that before Maine ratified the 19th Amendment, when it came before the state legislature, they actually voted against giving women the right to vote. So I think it's sort of a mixed case in terms of... And Portland has had a lot of women mayors, but part of it is because it hasn't been a strong mayor. It's been the state, it's been the city council picking the mayor until the current mayor. So I think it's kind of a mixed story.
All right. A question here for Sherry. What is the status of the Equal Rights Amendment, both statewide and federally? Anne, I know you know the answer.
Yeah, that great question. So in the last session, the legislature failed to pass the Maine Equal Rights Amendment, which is a pretty almost identical version of the National Equal Rights Amendment. So, and that vote went down on party lines. So all the Democrats were in favor and the Republicans were not. Nationally, we're in a really interesting position with this because in 1972 is when the Congress finally passed the Equal Rights Amendment. And they gave the supporters essentially 10 years to get it ratified. Three quarters of the states have to ratify in order for it to become part of the Constitution. And at the end of that 10-year period, they were just three states short. So they kind of abandoned the effort for a while, started to work on the states, passing that legislation in the states.
And we just have a few seconds. Just three states have recently ratified it, right?
Yeah, three states have ratified, and then keep an eye on what's happening in Congress.
All right. Well, thank you so much, all of you. Not enough time. Ann Gass, an historian and author of Voting Down the Rose. Beth DeWolf, history professor at UNE. Eileen Egan, retired from USM. And Candace Keynes, a journalist and historian. Lucy Suchak ran the board. Our theme song was composed by Mike Jandreau. I'm Jennifer Rooks. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.